faith and evolution have had a fraught relationship, since Darwin, I suppose, wrestled with it himself. A visiting ornithologist has no problem combining the two. He is Andy Goslar, Professor of Applied Ethnobiology and Conservation at the University of Oxford. He's also an ordained Anglican minister. And he's in New Zealand for a conference of Otago University, co-hosted by New Zealand Christians in Science, Beyond Conflict, Evolution, Science and God, it's called. He's also talking about conservation. Details of his other appearances are on our website. And Professor Goslar joins me now. Hello.
Hello.
Just admiring your tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
On your arm, which yeah. I think we were going to put a picture of on our webpage, but we haven't, but we will, for awesome. Those not privy. tell me about it. Because there you are. You're a sort of amiable, balding.
Hope so.
Vicar with a dog collar on.
Not a vicar. Please.
And you've got, well, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry. You told right. me not to call you a vicar and I immediately called you a vicar. And you've got this great tat on your arm.
Yeah.
Tell me what it is.
Yeah, so I had that 4 years ago. It's the logo for the research project that I'm involved in, which is called the Ethno-Ornithology World Atlas.
And fortunately, there's an acronym for that.
Yes, there is.
EWA. Yes.
And... the tattoo is of a sooty tern, in which is a seabird, in a sort of Polynesian kind of design, and it was based on, it was inspired by a tattoo by a friend of mine who designed it for us, and I gave him the brief. It cost me all of a bottle of whiskey and a box of chocolates, and he designed this thing, and the only brief he had for it was it had to be a sooty tern.
Why?
Can I come back to that in a second?
Yes.
Yeah. It had to be a sooty tern, and it had to somehow speak to birds and culture, the interface between birds and culture. So it had to be a sooty tern because I'd got the idea for the name of this atlas or archive. It actually started as an archive, and we changed its name last year, from a Hawaiian name for the sooty tern, which is Iwa Iwa. Apostrophe Iwa Iwa, and so I was looking for a neat, pithy little three-letter acronym, and I knew that the Hawaiian bird names often things like that, a bit like iwi, you know. And so I looked at this website, and I thought it's got to have an E in it for ethno-ornithology, and the only one was this Iwa Iwa. I thought. Ethno-Ornithology World Archive. Oh, my Lord. And I thought, okay, so what is an Iwa Iwa? It's a sooty tern. Now, a sooty tern is perfect for this because it has a global or pan-tropical distribution, so it connects people and cultures. The tern is also the logo for BirdLife International, which is the global NGO that we're working with. So it really links up everything. So it's just a perfect gift.
Perfect.
Yeah.
What's ethnobiology or ethno-ornithology specifically?
Okay. So ethno-ornithology, of course, is the bit of ethnobiology that is about birds. But ethnobiology studies the interface between people and nature. So biology, obviously, the science of life. Ethno, like ethnography.
I hate that word, interface. What does it mean?
Oh, the space between. Yeah, it's nasty, isn't it? Mm. Space between things. So, you know, we're interested in relationships. So relationships are, you know, in the space between, you know, the space between people, relationships, whatever. So the ethno-ornithology is bringing together a study of birds, study of people, but it's the study of people's relationship with birds. And ethnobiology is the study of people's relationship with nature. And of course, we came from nature. We evolved out of nature. We are part of nature. And the big, maybe I'm sort of jumping the gun a bit, but you know, the big problem of the world today, the great environmental crisis, comes out of this sense, particularly Western sense, that we're separate from nature. And of course, we're not. We're part of it. And that relationship with nature is expressed for people everywhere through this relationship, you know, what has academics, we might call ethnobiology, relationships between people and nature. So if you think, so how do we relate to nature? Well, through food, through drugs, through spiritual connections, through story. Any indigenous people have stories about plants and birds, you know, that teach them things. And
although, I don't want to argue with you at this point, but you did go to Nigeria and you did find a group of people there, the Musheri people.
The Musheri, yeah.
Who had culturally... Yes. Complete indifference.
Yes, well done.
To birds.
Yeah. So this was a graduate student of mine, Grace Pam, who's a Nigerian woman, and she spent 2 years with the Musheri people. This was her first work in ethnobiology, and she'd been strongly influenced, as had all of us, by work done in South America, you know, where everything. I have another student working with the Kayapo people in Brazil, you know, where their whole culture is based around birds. And so influenced by that literature, she goes off to the Musheri people, who own the Musheri forest. And so this was in connection with conserving the Musheri forest. And she finds these people that seemed to know nothing. and yeah, absolutely. It was such a sort of culture shock to us. We thought, oh my goodness, where are we going to go with this?
There goes that
PhD.
Theory.
Exactly. Yeah. So I said, okay, but this is new. We've got to ask why, because we know the kind of default state for people really is to be connected with their surroundings. And I think the big gap in our knowledge of the Musheri is the history, recent history probably, in the last few hundred years, of separation, which is probably something to do with, you know, influence of Europeans, of us, you know, in Nigeria. And possibly also the introduction of Western religion and Christianity. I won't say in particular, well, maybe in particular, which, depending on how the missionaries operated with those people, in separating them from their original sort of pagan beliefs, they came to think that all of the connections that they had with nature had to be ditched. So it's really throwing out the baby with the bathwater, which is incredibly sad. So there's now this Arosha project in Nigeria, which is trying to restore that connection with nature, but through their Christian belief. So it's a very, very interesting thing. So I think the story of the Musheri, although I am writing in the gaps, you know, between the lines, is that they almost certainly did have a stronger connection than Grace was able to find. Though having said that,
now you're thinking about
having
now.
Said that,
yes,
she did find, you know, when she worked on, okay, tell me what birds you know. And she did find they knew more than 100 species of birds, which actually, you know, if I went out in the street in the UK and asked anyone at random, you know, tell me the names of some birds, most people can't name 5. So,
well,
so
you've
actually
made this
they weren't
extraordinary
as...
claim that the first year of biology at Oxford,
yeah,
only about 40% of those students can name 5 British birds.
Yes.
Seriously?
Yes. So that's based on 3 years research that I did during the biology field course, where for 3 years they got a questionnaire at the start of the course that asked them...
sparrow?
Yes.
Pigeon?
Exactly. So, well, they only 42% could name 5 British birds to species level, okay? So that's rather than just saying... sparrow, saying house sparrow or something like that. But I mean, five species of birds, you know, songstress, blackbird. If they'd said robin, that would have been fine. They didn't have to say what kind of robin, you know. I was very open to whatever they said. In fact, if they gave me folk names of birds, they'd have got their points. So the
point here is that in the West, we've lost our knowledge of natural history.
Yes.
And this is what you're bent on reintroducing people to.
Yes.
When you were talking about possibly Christianity alienating the Mushiri people from their cultural knowledge, I felt Richard Dawkins coming upon me just for a moment. And he would say, yes, you know, there you go. Christianity's got a lot to answer for. And yet here you are, a person who converted to Christianity. You were raised liberal Judaism.
That's right.
And became, now you are ordained as a minister in the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
So, if I go back to age 13, 1971, after my bar mitzvah, I said to myself, right, well, that's religion done with. Now I'm going birding. And then I entered what I now think of as my wilderness years, from bar mitzvah to baptism. And how did... So it wasn't so much a jump from Judaism, because I wasn't sort of practicing, into Christianity, although when I found faith as a Christian, it made sense of my Jewish heritage. Richard Dawkins played a huge part in evangelizing me. He evangelized me more than anybody else. And
is that evangelization by irritation?
Yes. Yes, I think that's beautifully put. Because, you know, through the 1990s, I mean, I read The Selfish Gene in, I think it was 1978. It was published in 76 when I was an undergraduate. And I read that then. And even then, I saw, although, you know, nobody knew the truth or otherwise of the molecular biology that he was talking about, because I don't think anyone had ever sequenced a genome in 1976. There's a contradiction at the end of The Selfish Gene, because he builds this whole argument for genetic determinism. And then right at the end, he says, but it doesn't have to be like this. We can choose to deny the tyranny of our genes and be nice to one another. At which point you think, well, not if the rest of your book is true. Okay, so it's either one or the other. So... And as we know, the thing that you've just said is true. You've just undermined the whole argument for the selfish gene. So I've long had this slight sort of irritation. And when I came to Oxford, because everyone's raving about Richard Dawkins, so I read the next one, you know, The Extended Phenotype, The Blind Watchmaker, all of them. And increasingly, there's this drip, drip, drip of not just atheism, but specifically anti-Christian atheism, which basically boiled down to, look what these stupid Christians think. Now, for two reasons, that irritated me. The first was, hey, I don't want to know what Christians think. Just tell me about the dinosaurs, okay? So why do you keep telling me about Christians? And secondly, I know plenty of Christians who don't think that. Most Christians I know are not creationists.
To be fair, I think that he was writing at a point where he perceived a rise of kind of anti-evolutionary fundamentalist Christianity.
Yes.
And was fighting that.
Well, yeah, but I mean that comes from a particular place in the US where, you know, and it's not what he was meeting in Oxford. And he got himself into a slangy match with those people. And so increasingly, you know, so I'm a horse rider. And as a horseman, I've learnt that if you want a horse to do something, tell it not to do it. And using the same psychology with me, continuously telling me not to be a Christian when I wasn't and didn't want to be, made me want to know about this thing that I wasn't supposed to do. And one day I was walking past a secondhand bookshop in Oxford Thornton's, it's no longer exists. And my eye was caught by a rather nice tie in the window, and I went in. I actually bought the tie, but I had a browse around. I was
starting to get... Don't need ties anymore now, do you?
No, just I don't. Exactly. That's brilliant. You know, I no longer have to worry which tie shall I wear. Just wear the collar. Yeah, no, it's that's
very
cool.
Liberating.
It's very. It is liberating.
What that's more reason right. would you have for becoming ordained?
Well, you know, Faith.
Anyway, there you were in the bookshop.
There I was in the bookshop, and I started browsing in the sort of religion section. I thought, so what we got here? What have we got here? And I found a book, it was about 300 pages, dense text, no pictures. It was called Belief in God, and it was written by a man, Gareth Morris, who was a Dominican. And I read the preface, and I thought, this is the most rational thing I've ever read in my life. What's this? £1.25. Yeah, I think we can stretch to that. So I bought that. I read that book. And then I started exploring. And I started exploring the interface between science. Sorry, that word again. Between science and religion. And, of course, I'd been sold a pup by Richard Dawkins because... he didn't want people to know that space is actually fertile ground for finding connection between things.
So do you think that he was irrationally looking at the Bible as literal truth and saying anybody who believes this is a fool?
Yeah.
Whereas you would see it as symbolism and allegory?
Exactly. I mean, I was taught as a child in the liberal synagogue to read it as allegory. I had never been taught at school or at home or in synagogue that this was literally true. And the first time I understood that anyone thought of it as literally true, so we're talking Genesis 1 to 3 particularly, was Richard Dawkins telling me that. And I think, really? Really? And so if his whole atheism was based on this misreading
Well, it's not
Genesis,
entirely, is it? I mean, he also points to the terrible conflict that belief in religion, not just Christianity, but religion in general, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, whatever, terrible conflict and bloodshed it causes. And that's another of his bete noire.
Well, conflict is caused by tribalism. Conflict is well, it's caused by all sorts of things, but it becomes possible, a sort of bloody conflict becomes possible because one group of people demonize another group of people. And you know, so once dialogue
and so
stops,
Dawkins would argue that religion gives them the means by which to do that.
Exactly. He would see religion as just another form of tribalism, whereas... you know, the detail, you have to read the Gospels to understand what is Jesus actually about. The other day I was talking to someone about my college, Mansfield College, which is started as a nonconformist seminary, if you like. In the chapel, the stained glass windows are all non-conformists, and people, we now dine in the chapel. We have all our meals in the chapel. And so people come in there who would never otherwise do so. And they say, who are these people? And they say, oh, the non-conformists. Who's that? Oh, that's St. Francis. Oh, who's that? Oh, that's Jesus. What do you mean Jesus was a non-conformist? Of course Jesus was a non-conformist. He was attacking the religious structures, the hypocrisy and religious structures of his day. Now, you know, one of the attractions of the New Testament for me when I discovered it was because my father, to his dying day, described himself as a card-carrying atheist. He wasn't very good at it, but bless him. And one of the grounds for his atheism, when we were very young, although you know, they sent us off to Sunday school, but was religious hypocrisy. What he saw as hypocrisy. And so when I read Mark's Gospel for the first time, I found a Jesus who sounded like my father, attacking religious hypocrisy and tribalism and saying, you know these Samaritans who you think have horns? You know, I'm going to tell you a story about the Samaritans. you know. The Samaritans weren't properly Jewish, you know, they were idol worshippers. They were kind of Jewish, but they worshipped idols. So, of course, the sort of kosher, if you like, Jewish people of the time regarded them as, you know, outside. But Jesus said, well, you know, I'm going to tell you a story about a Samaritan. So who do you think did the right thing? Was it this priest or this outsider? And so many of his stories are like that.
He was a disruptor. So was science proving inadequate on its own for you?
Yes.
Why?
Because science, by its nature, has to objectify everything. So we do science by measurement, but we have a very specific way of looking at things. So we make observations, and because we don't know what the future will be, we try and make predictions about the future to build models of the present. That's how science works. But we can't live by the numbers. Our life is much richer than that. On one level, you can say, well, there must be something else going on in the human psyche, because actually most people on the planet have some sort of spiritual sense. I'd sort of characterize it like this, a model that I try and give people to help them think about the spiritual as opposed to everything else in our lives. If you think, and it relates to time, because time's incredibly weird, slippery thing. So everything that exists in the present moment. Everything that exists in the present moment. So, but where is the present moment? What is the present moment? So because I'm bound in time, I can only think of the present as where the past meets the future.
The interface,
exactly. Beautiful, well done. The interface between the past and the future. But the past doesn't exist, because everything that exists in the present. The past, an infinite number of past present moments have left, you know, echoes, if you like, into the present. But the past doesn't exist, and the future doesn't exist. So the present, where I live and move and have my being, exists as the meeting point between two non-existent things. And that gives existence itself a mystical quality. And we can't actually look directly on the present moment. The moment I say, oh, this is the present, oh, it's gone, right? I can't look on that moment that is so instantaneous. You know, if I chop it down to half a second, a quarter of a second, a millisecond, a milli, whatever, second, yeah, but still, that instantaneous, what Eliot called the still point, has no time.
Couldn't you think that that's why we have science? To try to make the past real and the future foreseeable.
So science tries to, because we can't look directly on the present, science tries to construct models of the present by making predictions of the future.
Yeah.
And saying, so our hypotheses are, okay, if I have an idea of how I think things are, how I think the present is, so based on my observations of the past, if the present is like this, if I do X, it might be an experiment, it might be more observations, whatever, then if this happens, then I have more confidence in my model.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always a model. It's like, you know, St. Paul says, I look through a glass darkly.
Yeah.
And so we're always refining our model of the present. But none of this can ever, because we can't look directly on the present that is where reality actually is. there is something
and
that science can't explain.
And as God enabled you, or Jesus enabled you, or Christianity's enabled you to be in the moment. Is that what it is?
Yes. So contemplative prayer. Prayer is really about, you know, mindfulness. Everyone's talking about mindfulness. It's all about, you know, finding that present moment. So it is a spiritual exercise. It is a spiritual exercise. And prayer is about getting into that moment where actually God is for
us.
So
you could you have chosen any religion? Why was Anglican calling to you? Apart from the obvious, I mean, there you are in Oxford, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, if I look at the sort of history of my coming to faith, Richard Dawkins was never saying, look what these stupid Muslims think. He was always ever saying, or these stupid Jews or whatever. He was only ever saying, look what these stupid Christians think. And so because I was sort of responding to this, you know, don't do that. then I guess that took me down that path because this was the thing I was being told not to do. And then, of course, it connects with my own history as a child and my own personal, my own cultural heritage because I am a Jew. And that's another thing that I've come to realize later. Thinking about the Dawkins thing, was that he was bashing my cultural heritage and telling me, well, if you want to be an evolutionary biologist, you've got to ditch that. And actually our roots, our identity, is incredibly important to me, to us, to everyone as human beings. So you might not have a scientific explanation for that, but identity is important.
So did your becoming a Christian affect the kind of science you did?
Yes. So I think that the shift that I've made, the career move that I've made from pure ecology and ornithology, so just studying birds, into ethno-ornithology, which is saying, you know, if we want to do conservation effectively, we can't just do the science of ecology. We've got to connect with people. And the moment we say, and around the world, in thousands of different cultures, and the moment we say, well, we want to do conservation effectively and it's got to involve local people, then we've got to understand their traditions and their beliefs and their mindsets. And we've got to respect those things.
Can I just ask you this? Because, I mean, I understand that, you know, it's possible to read the Bible, for example, as symbolism and allegory. But it says quite specific things about, you know, man having dominion over everything else. Mm. That's explicit, right?
So, well, it is and it isn't. It depends how you understand dominion. So many people just reading that have thought, well, that means we can do what we like with it.
No, well, it means that the Bible isn't the primary conservation manifesto.
it is. So put the Bible aside for a second.
All right.
And say, look at how the world is today. Look at what's happening in the Amazon burning. The future of life in this planet is in our hands. Whether you have any religious belief, faith or otherwise, the state of the planet depends on decisions that we, Homo sapiens, make now, and we need to make those things quickly. So in a very real sense, whether anyone had ever read the Bible or not, we do have dominion. And we need to understand the biblical sense of dominion involves responsibility. So Genesis also says, it's the only place I have ever read any sense of purpose to our species, that we were put in the garden to look after it. So we were put on the planet to look after it, and we better start doing that.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you. I've been talking to Professor Andy Gosler, and for his appearances while he's here in the country. He's from Oxford. You can look on our webpage.